Okay, I'm Bill Jones, and this is, March 10th?
10th?
Yeah,
10th, I think
March
it is.
10th, and I'm with Jerry Hockebo, and we are recording an interview as part of the Heritage Commission Oral History Project. Jerry, I think we ought to start with some kind of biographical review of where you started and what you've done, briefly sketch it before arriving at your present point.
Okay, sure. Actually, where we're sitting today is not too far from where I was born, 55, 65 miles. My original home was Underwood, Minnesota. My dad was a merchant there. My mother had been an elementary school teacher, having taken normal training at, I think, what they call Park Region College in Fergus Falls.
Mm-hmm.
Dad was a merchant, had a general store that grew and evolved into a grocery store. I was the, from a family of nine. I was the first boy born into the family after five daughters, and so there was, I'm told, some kind of celebration.
Well, I'm sure you were made
on
welcome.
Part of my father, sure. I have one brother and seven sisters, actually, in all. Went through elementary school there. My eldest sister, Kelly, had started the pattern for all of our family to go on to college. That was not true of my father. My mother had gone the normal training route. She had gotten a scholarship to McAllister. She was valedictorian of her class. But finances did not allow her to continue it at McAllister, so she transferred to Morehead State on a two-year program. I'm leading up to the point that she subsequently married a county superintendent up in Roseau County, northern part of the state, and I went to spend one summer with them up there and liked the community, and I got some jobs working in the rural school supply store in the basement of the courthouse and asked my parents for permission to attend high school up there. So I was not at Underwood during high school years, went to high school the 4 years up at Roseau. From there, it was a question of how college. With a family of nine, there had been a pattern of the oldest helping the next, but that had been interrupted just before me. And so that was not a possibility, and I thought about military academy. In fact, had an appointment from Harold Hagen at Crookston to go to West Point. But this announcement came at a point, after all, I already had a year of military. I had joined the Marine Corps right out of high school. The GI Bill offered for 2 years of service, 36 months of college. That was a part of that great program. And when I got the letter from Harold Hagen, I'd had a year of the military and decided that was not for me, and I had the alternate route to college.
Mm-hmm.
So it was back to this region. One of my high school chums influenced me. I attended Concordia College. I maybe had some aspirations of playing basketball, but too short, too slow, and not athletic enough to do that. He did make the team there, and I had joined him for 2 years. And then, in 1946, married a high school honey, Doris May Alley from Roseau.
Mm-hmm.
And she was at nurse's training at the University of Minnesota and at Minneapolis General Hospital, and so I transferred to the University of Minnesota, where I earned my bachelor's degree. And so that started my work in academia.
Mm-hmm. Had you had a vision of being a teacher as you were working toward your baccalaureate?
Yes, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned my mother had been a teacher. The five older sisters of mine, one, two, three, four of them attended Morehead State, all of them in teacher preparation programs. I lived with the county superintendent.
Sure.
And my oldest sister, his wife, had been a teacher, was a teacher intermittently during their married life. I worked in the rural school supply store in the basement of the courthouse and had contact with teachers there. So, yes, I...
It was a natural thing.
It was a natural. I was intrigued by it. I was altruistic about what I thought teaching could do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I very much had in mind. Now, what levels and what subjects to teach? I had thought about either mathematics or elementary, and my brother-in-law, the county superintendent, influenced me to think about elementary because he thought we needed many more men in the elementary school and there were opportunities. As it turned out, he was absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good choice for me.
D- Did you go on into a teaching situation then after your first degree?
Yes. In fact, I graduated from the University of Minnesota in March, did some substitute teaching in the Twin Cities schools. For the balance of that school year, was hired to teach at the Charles A. Lindbergh School in Little Falls. Mm-hmm. Went there for 2 years, but while that spring quarter after graduation, I started on a master's degree program, and I came back from summers from Little Falls to continue the work on bachelor's or the master's degree program in educational administration. I was wanting to prepare for elementary principalship during that same time. So, right from the degree into teaching, but also graduate school at that same time.
Mm-hmm. Then you completed your master's degree?
In time, the summer of 54, when Doris and I, and by then we had daughter Beth, born in 1953, we left for Santa Barbara, California. Mm-hmm. It was a time when the California schools, you would know this well, I'm sure, shortage of teachers, superintendents were supposedly described as brushing up on suntan and then coming back to the Midwest in the heart of winter to recruit teachers. I could have had jobs any place in California, I guess, very easily. Santa Barbara, we were told, was a delightful city. We found it to be true. We moved out there for 1 year. And then adventure called. One of my older sisters that I told about had gone into teaching, had taught with the Army Dependent Schools in Europe. And what she wrote about that very much intrigued us. We interviewed with an Army recruiting team, civilian recruiting team in in California, and were selected to go to Germany that fall of 55. So that began 4 years of teaching and administration in the Army Dependent Schools of Europe.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Was this elementary school again?
Right. Mm-hmm. First year was Stuttgart, Germany. There was a sizable school there, I suppose. Let's see, there was elementary, junior, and senior high. It was a big operation for the military. We had something like 24 elementary teachers. Mm-hmm. The high school must have had 800 students, something like that. We moved each year while in Germany. That first year was at Stuttgart, and that was a good assignment. The next year I was made a teaching principal of a small eight-teacher school in a medieval city called Schwäbisch Gmund. It's on an old Roman road and a very charming community. Met some friends at that time who were in what is called a Bergwacht group, a mountain patrol, ski patrol. They were people who spent a lot of time in the mountains, weekends, loved nature, studied mountain rescue techniques and so forth. But it was also very much a social organization. They had built their own lodge up in the Schwäbisch Alps. And so we got to know them.
And these are German nationals now.
German nationals, right. Mm-hmm. There was a group of, membership was about 400. There were maybe 50 of them, very active. And we still have contacts with them. We've been back to visit them a few times. And it was a very influential kind of period in our life in terms of international understanding and so forth. The following year, I was made assistant principal of a large elementary school in Nuremberg. Nuremberg was one of the larger military installations. And the elementary school had something like 8 or 9 buildings. It was a little college campus kind of setting, actually. And then the fourth year, it was back to my own school of about 20 teachers. This was a natural progression up the general service classification. Promotion each year and a different community. And when we initially went over, we were going for 1 or 2 years. We stayed for 4 ultimately. And even then, I guess both Doris and I were tearful as we flew away from Frankfurt to come back to the States.
Now, you had another child there?
We had two children born in Germany, yes. They have birth certificates in German and in English. Right. So we came back with 3 children.
And obviously that's must have been one of the factors that gave you an interest in foreign languages, too.
Right? Very much, yes, yeah. Yes.
Did you get fairly fluent in German during the course of
that
had
to work at, yes, I felt comfortable with German. I'm sure there was some dialect because the Bergwacht group that I was with, they were essentially Schwäbisch, and I know I picked up some of the dialect there. I had studied 2 years of German while in college. And though we lived in American communities there, we sought out every opportunity to relate to the nationals. And we did through the Bergwacht group and through other kinds of groups. And so, yeah, I felt rather comfortable in oral German.
Well, you really took advantage of a unique opportunity. Then,
right, yeah. It really was a good opportunity.
Okay, coming back to the USA, then what happened?
Okay, that was kind of a crossroads again, professionally. There was still a teacher shortage. We could have taught, for example, in Minneapolis or St. Paul public schools. It would have been very easy to get a job there, and there were some attractions about that, higher pay scales there at that time, good retirement programs. I had opportunity to be a principal in a smaller school in southern Minnesota. That had some appeal, but I really was rather troubled as a teacher and as a principal, again, maybe the altruism or idealism here showing through, that that we weren't doing as well as we could in the matter of teaching in our schools. And while I was preparing to teach, I was going to do something different. When I was teaching, I thought I could do some things differently. When I became a principal, I was concerned about how some of my people taught. And right away, it was a question of looking at their training. What was the nature of their training? How could that have been improved so they would have been better teachers? And so the third avenue opened to me, teaching elementary principalship, was teacher preparation. Mm-hmm. And the opportunity to join the faculty at Concordia College won out. I had been offered a contract to join their education faculty.
So this was in
1959.
59.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we came back to Moorhead. We had been away from this region for 5 years. We had delightful experiences, California and Europe, but we also thought we ought to, for ourselves and for our children, sink some roots here for a while. So that was also a factor in deciding that.
And your responsibilities at Concordia then were?
Well, yeah, I had a regular teaching kind of load. It was kind of diverse. There was an introductory course for preparation of teachers. I had the mathematics or the arithmetic methods course. I had a human geography course, which was a requirement for elementary teachers, required by the state, and Concordia did not have a geography department as such, and so I had that. Seems to me one or two other courses over the span of several mm-hmm. years would vary, not every course offered every semester.
Concordia always had the reputation, or certainly had a reputation at that time, as being a place that was preparing teachers and preachers.
Right.
Was that the case when you were there, that a fairly sizable portion of the student body was preparing?
Yes, I think that's true.
Mm-hmm.
The elementary education program was a relatively new one at the time I came there. They had really been into the preparation of secondary, so people majoring in the various departments. The education department was expanded to prepare elementary teachers, and part of that, I guess, in response to the continuing teacher shortage.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it, I think, in response to requests of students who sought to come to Concordia but wanted to be prepared for elementary education.
Mm-hmm. And were you on in the early stages of that, or it had been established prior to your coming?
Yeah, it was established prior to my coming. There was mm-hmm. an established program that mm-hmm. I fit into.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Now, the Concordia to which you came there was what size institution?
Let's see. That would have been 1,500 or 1,600,
mm-hmm.
I think. Mm-hmm. I'm not certain of that, Bill, but it seems to me it was about that size. Just a short while before that, I think, Moorhead State had surpassed Concordia in terms of enrollment.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that as being a topic that was discussed there a bit.
Yeah, yeah. Now, obviously, one important aspect of your work at Concordia was something outside of teacher preparation, and that was your involvement in the development of the language camps.
Right.
How did you get started in that?
Okay, yeah. There's a very specific time that I can point to that I can remember rather very vividly, as a matter of fact. I had a colleague, Erhard Friedrichsmeier, who was a teacher of German in the German department at Concordia, or Modern Languages department. He and I were on our way to a fishing trip up Lake of the Woods. It would have been May, I suppose, of maybe my first year there, 59-60, in the spring of 60.
Did you have your island up in the Lake of the Woods at that point?
No, we did not, no.
Yeah.
But we loved the lakes, and Friedrichsmeier had not done much fishing, and so I was going to be his kind of guide and introduce him to that sport in Minnesota. In a trip like that, you have a chance to range over a number of topics, and one of the things we talked about, I had been very impressed while a teacher and a principal in the Army Dependent Schools in Europe with the young people's capacity or ability to learn a language. We had daily language instruction in all of the military schools in Europe, taught typically by nationals, but that would start in the kindergarten.
Hmm.
And so all of our students there had daily instruction. And you could see how quickly they could pick it up and how accurate pronunciation quickly developed. But what was even more impressive is when a youngster perhaps would visit a German family for a week or two, be surrounded by the culture, the land, the sounds, and the customs and so forth, what kind of transformation would happen after just a week or two of that, how they'd come back to their family and how they could speak the language. Many cases we knew of where youngsters learned the language much faster than the parents, would answer the door for German salesmen, door-to-door salesmen or whatever, would ask directions for their parents and other kinds of cases. This capacity for learning language was impressive, and we were talking about that. And the notion of, well, is there a chance to try to simulate that immersion is really what kind of evolved from that discussion. And the more I thought about it, the more exciting that prospect would be. It was a matter of role-playing a little bit, the acting that youngsters would like. And Erhard Friedrichsmeyer was a dynamic teacher. He had a lot of energy, a lot of vitality, and so forth. He left the following year to do his more work on his doctorate at the University of Minnesota. But I was at Concordia to explore and develop and expand this idea. And I'd get in touch with him periodically with some of the details of what was happening. I got permission from the administration to attempt something that would simulate the culture, that would immerse young people. When thinking about this, we thought about, well, we have to have youngsters old enough to be away from home for a period of time, and yet we want them young enough to take advantage of that affinity for language. So we ended up with thinking about 9 to 12-year-olds. Next, we needed to think about some kind of a place where we could bring them. The Concordia affiliation led us to officials of Luther Crest Bible Camp down at Lake Carlos, Alexandria. Went down to visit that site, and it was beautiful, beautiful lake, and a number of individual cabins, a larger building that would serve as school, a number of other buildings that would help in the purpose here. So the excitement kind of increased here, heightened. And we're trying to think of all the ways we could simulate the culture. And certainly we ought to have a store, and we ought to have foods that are going to be typical. We ought to have menus that represent the culture. We ought to have school daily, and we ought to have teachers for that. We ought to use the money. We ought to have geographic names here that somehow or other are representative. And so a lot of ideas here, and we got that gelled. We got approval from the Concordia College. We were a bit of a financial risk, I suppose. We hit on an amount that would cover paying college students or graduate students in the language a bit of a money. We had an announcement in the forum, and within a matter of just a few weeks, we had 75 youngsters, which we considered capacity.
So clearly there was latent demand.
Absolutely,
there.
Yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. Very, very definitely. And we had recruited a faculty of 8. Our plan was 4 male counselors, 4 female counselors, 1 nurse, the head teacher, which was Friedrichsmeyer, the dean of the camp, and I'd be the administrative coordinator of all of this. We found a delicatessen or specialty shop in St. Paul that had an abundant supply of imported candy from Germany and Austria and Switzerland. We sent to, through a local bank, got German marks and pfennigs from Germany, and we were ready for the students. We met at the camp on a Saturday. Students were invited to come in Sunday afternoon. There was a frantic pace to get it all converted. We had put speakers in each of the cabins. That was going to be our radio system, the one that would wake youngsters up in the morning and play music of the culture and so forth. When the youngsters came in, it was electric. They were ready. They came to a bank, turned in their American money and got German money. They quickly went over to the camp store and see all of the candy that was available. Many parents were disappointed that the kids didn't even have time to say goodbye. They were into it that quickly. And the excitement didn't really desist all of that week or 2 weeks.
So it was a two-week session.
Two-week session, time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that was in the latter part of August when the Bible camp session was over. I remember one little 9-year-old from Warren. I saw him sitting on a step of one of the buildings, and he looked kind of sad, and I went over to talk to him. Yes, he was homesick. Did he want to go home? Oh, no, he didn't want to go home. By the time the first session was over, most of those kids say, can we do this again next year? In fact, 62 of the 75 did come back the following year. It was
fantastic.
Yeah. It was an exciting time, no question about it.
And probably for most of them, not any real follow-up at school.
No, that's true.
During the course
right,
of that.
Yeah. It did help generate interest on the part of some of the parents to get programs going in schools. In fact, it was kind of a hot commodity for a while, going out and speaking to schools about languages and young people's facility for learning it and so forth. Yeah, it helped generate some interest. The following year, because of that interest, we knew we had to expand, and we expanded to offer French. And the following year, the third year then, we added Spanish and Norwegian. The year following that was Russian, so we had, within about 4 years, 5 different languages that were offered, and they all continue, and they've been expanded now. I guess there are 4 additional languages in that whole program.
Hmm. Were you involved in the acquisition of the language camp site?
Yes, very much so. In fact, again, the idea for coming up with that facility, creating our own setting, we were, each year, it was a bit like setting up a circus or something. You'd come in and try to set up your environment, and then you have to take it down after the 2 or 4 weeks of your one or two sessions. I was riding up to Bemidji, where we were leasing a camp, with a young student, a photographer, we brought along to take some pictures of what was happening. And it was his idea, say, wouldn't it be great if you had your own place that where the facilities, the architecture was actually reflected and so forth. Well, of course it was a beautiful idea, just tremendous idea. So that led to a couple of things. One, again, some permission from the university Concordia College, to explore that whole notion. We could do it, but college money could not be applied to it. It would have to be done within the language village's budget. I had some mentors who were in development at Concordia. Gail Mitchell was very much one in the development staff at that time, who was very helpful. He said, what you ought to do, you've got a great number of people who are interested in the language village's program, and many of them, I think, would be willing to work as volunteers in support of some longer-range plans. That led to the creation of a Concordia College Language Villages Development Council. And we recruited Dr. Charles H. Mayo II, who is fourth-generation Mayo family, to chair that group. And the contact with him was an interesting one. He had been taking Norwegian down in Rochester on an evening class.
The Mayos are Norwegian originally.
No.
Oh, is that
no,
right?
No, this, he just has an interest in language.
Right.
No, the name is Scottish, apparently. It's, what did I hear? Mayhew.
Oh, yeah.
Would have been an early spelling or something.
Mm-hmm.
But he was studying that just out of interest. His wife is Scandinavian. His teacher was the dean of our Norwegian camp at the time. So when we started talking about creating this board, the dean offered his name, and I reached him on telephone, drove down to Rochester. Of course, he would be happy to head up such a group, and we ended up with about a dozen people serving on that board. We had some very good people. Bob Stassen, who heads up an insurance company in St. Paul. Arthur Naftlin was mayor of Minneapolis. He served at that time. Bob Forsyth was a candidate for U.S. Senate around that time. He was been active in Republican. I think he was party chair in Minnesota for a bit of time. He served on it. We had a vice president of Glisson Laughlin Steel, and that man was out of Ohio, Don Reed. He was a relentless worker for our program. When this board was created, we decided that we would invite chambers of commerce of communities in the lake region. We wanted a site that was obviously on a lake. To nominate sites. So a letter went out from Dr. Mayo to 15 chambers of commerce from Alexandria up to Grand Rapids, roughly that western central part of Minnesota. We got letters back from all places. There were a total of 29 sites that were nominated. And that summer of about 65, Dr. Mayo and I, he as chair and me as the staff person, visited all 29 of them.
Got to know each other very well.
Yeah, we did. Yes, we did. There was a Pillsbury hunting camp down, I think, by Deer Creek. There was a beautiful lake home and extensive land up on Cass Lake that was owned by a Minneapolis dairy. We had beautiful sites. Cass Lake itself nominated one out on a peninsula on Cass Lake, and they were proposing that campers depart from the city. Oh, this is Walker, depart from the city by boat, say goodbye to their family then on their way to the new land, which would be the language village out on that peninsula. From those 29, we narrowed it down to 5, and the entire board visited those 5 sites. The 5 sites were, I'm not sure I remember all, from Alexandria up to Bemidji. And the Bemidji site was a unanimous choice. It had 800 acres of land, 2.5 miles of shoreline. It contained completely a small lake, Buck Lake, within the property. It was near a city that was served by air, rail, bus. And the community of Bemidji quickly raised about 8% of the selling price of that. We had a down payment just from them.
Mm-hmm.
We acquired that property, and the payments for it were made from Language Village's budget, so it didn't encumber the university at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was a buy. It was a less than $3 a foot frontage for lakeshore property. So the owner was also interested in seeing Language Village's being located near Bemidji, so that also was part of them.
Now, what languages eventually were represented there? You didn't accommodate the whole program.
No, right? In fact, we acquired the property, and it was about that time then that I left to complete my degree and came over to Morehead State.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We had 5 languages at the time. We had taken steps to acquire the property. We did one more thing before I left the Language Villages program, and that was Dr. Mayo, an architect from a firm that the Concordia College traditionally worked with, and I visited 4 countries in Europe to talk with both youth leaders, educators, and architects about what the interpretation of the culture ought to be out at the Language Villages. We were pretty much agreed it was not going to be a stereotype. Why create something now that would be a typical of 100 or 200 years ago? It ought not to be a Disneyland. It ought to be a genuine reflection of that culture. And how to do that was a tough kind of question. Mm-hmm. And so we thought we'd like to converse with people from the respective countries about that interpretation. So we did that as well prior to my leaving that program.
Mm-hmm. And it ultimately is a program that has a national clientele. I mean, it's no longer a regional.
Oh, not at all. In fact, by the time I left, we had, I think we'd had students from 20-some states. In fact, mm-hmm. I know we had coast-to-coast easily. Mm-hmm. I remember one young tyke that had, a 10-year-old that had come from Washington, D.C. She, when she arrived at the language camp that she was going to attend, I asked her about her trip. She'd been on the bus for 2 days. Had you had to change buses? Yes, Philadelphia, Cleveland, Chicago, Minneapolis. But she was intent
quite
on
a trip.
Yeah.
She
was one of our first minority students. I also remember from that
mm-hmm.
from that perspective, a bright young student in the French camp.
Now, obviously, that was a major contribution that you made at Concordia. Are there any other highlights of your Concordia experience that you might find it useful to record?
Well, that certainly was the main one, and there was I'd have to say that was a good administrative climate for doing that. While we had to be self-sufficient, there was freedom to do that, and I pay tribute to Dr. Knutson and mm-hmm. Bill Smaby, business manager at the time, and Carl Bailey, academic vice president mm-hmm. or academic dean, for allowing a young professor, untested in higher education, to move forward on this kind of project. That was a blessing. We tried one other thing that was not really successful, and for a couple of reasons. A colleague, Ken Bailey, who was in philosophy department, and I, thought, well, Concordia ought to be into adult education in some kinds of ways, and we've got time and space and summer. So we came up with a program. We had Paul J. Christensen, who was going to spend one day with people that we would attract to the campus, talking about music. They'd have a chance to relate to him day long and really find out his thoughts on music. The next day, Cy Running in art. Third day, Armour Nelson in English literature. Fourth day was going to be Ken Bailey in philosophy. We had a fifth person as well. So we had a five-day, and we called it Liberal Arts Institute. It's kind of a heavy name for for that. The people who attended were interested, but it did not continue in that form. I think it was maybe one of the antecedents to Communiversity, in a sense, the idea of the college reaching out and...
Sounds a little bit like Elder Hostel, too.
Yes, yeah, certainly, yeah. And for some of the people who attended, it was very exciting to be with people so accomplished in their particular fields.
Okay, well, then we moved to Morehead State. And what attracted you there?
Several things. John Neumayer was president here. I'd gotten into discussions with him, had differences of opinion with him on one occasion that lasted till wee hours in the morning, and we were talking about pedagogy. And he had strong opinions, and I had some of my own, and we argued about it. I respect him for engaging that kind of argument, I think he respected me for differing with him. That was of some appeal. About that time, I knew I had to finish my doctor's degree. I had started on that when I had come back from Europe, summers at the University of Minnesota. Trying to have this go along with Language Villages was a fairly heavy load. And I had gotten a sabbatical at Concordia 1 year there after my third year to work on. So I'd made substantial progress, but I had to wrap that up. And so I had resigned at Concordia the summer of 66, went to work on degree. And then I thought, well, I want to try something else, and I want to get more actively engaged in teacher education. That earlier idealistic notion about that had some notions that there could be substantial kind of improvement. I had felt that there wasn't a strong interest in that at Concordia. There was interest in the secondary teacher training, but we had a kind of standard elementary program. So the possibility of doing that at an institution which had a great tradition in teacher education was also of appeal. And so I visited with John Neumayer and was offered a contract, and started in January of 67. I right away had some administrative kind of responsibilities. I was named director of student teaching. There was an opening about that time. And it seemed to me, well, that's one way to leverage the training programs. Sure. And so that was of appeal. And then, I don't know that President Neumayer had this in mind, but the following fall, I was made department chairman. I had not known that when I came here.
That wasn't one of the original contractual arrangements.
No. Made department chair, and that was a sizable department, 32 or 34 people. It had elementary, secondary, special education. Remedial reading was a part of the program. Early childhood was Dorothy Dodds in that program. And so the whole range of teacher education out here was going to be my chance to try to influence teacher education. And my colleagues in the department had similar kinds of notions that there ought to be some ways to strengthen. Frankly, the education courses had a bit of a bad name. They were things that you were required to take. Those weren't necessarily the courses that you sought. And part of the problem, it seemed, was the fact that students required to take this were taking courses which essentially presented theory and an array of those, and then finally they'd get a chance to go out and practice it with their student teaching. And it seemed to me that that was, to a lot of us, that was the converse of what learning theory would suggest, that you might go from specific, concrete kinds of things to something more abstract, you'd conceptualize. Well, to do that on the course in a program was a different kind of matter, but a number of people and the elementary ed faculty agreed to come back early in the fall of 67 or 68, 67 very likely, to just talk about elementary education program and how we might revamp that. It led to a rather radical change, the creation of the professional fourth year, PFY, which would it didn't deal completely with this idea of going from the concrete to the abstract, but it allowed the theory and the practice to be complement each other.
Right.
And so we were able to develop a kind of program of that sort. There was some great kind of planning, some dedicated people within the department. We got approval from the appropriate curriculum committee and Senate at the university, approval from the academic vice president and from the dean, or the president, to go ahead. And that made a substantial difference, I think, in terms of how students view their training program. I saw any number of examples of that. I think the program is basically quite sound. Mm-hmm. It attracted students, I know, from other institutions. I know personally of a neighbor of a family in Austin, Minnesota, that came to Moorhead because of professional fourth year. He had learned about that.
No, it's still in effect, too.
Yes, it is. Yeah. There have been modifications of it. It took some good kind of cooperation with the area schools, because it meant no longer would they have a student for 3 months full time, mm-hmm. but they would have a student a week in, week out, and they'd have that student all year long. And typically, they'd have two students. One would be in while one was out. That was a kind of compromise to an organization thing here. It meant that a number of faculty were dealing with individual students at any given time. It meant that any methods course would allow some kind of immediate testing, or testing pretty soon in the classroom. And so,
right.
Yeah.
So that's frankly, it's quite remarkable for any curriculum innovation to have lasted 20 years.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
You usually expect a kind of a 10-year cycle, and then mm-hmm. somebody else gets a gleam in their eye and wants to reform and have some of their ideas. So it's a testimony to, I think, the basic soundness of the approach. Anything else that you recall as far as your Moorhead State experience that... you came in at the time when there was still a really substantial demand for teachers.
Yes, that's right.
But that was a peak which gradually started to be declined from there.
Right.
Are there some circumstances there that... are significant as far as you're involved?
Well, it was during my tenure that the lab school was closed.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that we had, well, that was happening all over. A number of state universities had lab schools. I think all of them were closed except for St. Cloud, Mankato, if I'm not mistaken. That meant the loss of some kind of opportunities that we had, and it put greater demands on our working with the area schools. But the area schools have been very good in collaboration on teacher training programs. The interest in things international still was with me, and John Neumeyer had recruited some faculty people here at Moorhead State that were representative of other cultures, other nations, and so forth. And in our department, one of them that really stuck out was Dr. Herbert Abraham. Herbert was originally English, had a scholarship to Oxford, later got his PhD at Ohio State University, worked with UNESCO for about a dozen years. He was a head of their Education for International Understanding program out of the UNESCO headquarters in Paris. John Neumeyer, on a trip to Europe, had recruited him.
Hmm.
He was a great asset in our department. He taught particularly comparative education, the study of other educational systems. And he at one point suggested, well, we ought to take a tour of, or offer to area teachers a tour of Europe, study other school systems. That's part of his comparative education kind of interests. And we did that. We arranged for a tour in the summer of about... 68 or 69. There were 15 or 20 area teachers who signed up for that tour. I remember the cost was only like $450 at that time. And Herbert and his wife, Jo Abraham, led that tour. the then academic vice president, Bob Hansen, and I decided to go along and to bring our wives along. So we paid, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But we wanted to learn from Herbert and wanted to tour Europe. While we were over there, it would have been in England, and we were visiting an international school of London, that Joe Abraham said, wouldn't it be interesting if we could ever send some of our student teachers over here to this international school? And it was an exciting idea, absolutely exciting. We visited with the headmaster of that particular school. Sir, he would consider taking a couple students from Morehead State next year at some time. Well, every other stop on our trip, we made some more visits. In Paris, it was to Ecole Bilingue, Dr. Rochelle Cohen. Yes, she would take student teachers, true in Munich and Geneva and Madrid. So by the time we got back, we had at least five, six, seven schools. A couple of the cities, there were several. Geneva, there were a couple of international schools to where we could send student teachers. And the following year, by spring quarter, we did that. And that was good for our students. It was great for the schools over there. It enriched our program here a bit because these people, when they returned, had a different perspective on a lot mm-hmm. of things. And so that became a sustaining program within department. It was headed up by Hal Janik for a while. And then for most of the years, Dr. Howard Freeburg, a tireless leader of that program. What did I see? The latest figures, he's had 1,300 student teachers placed in schools on five continents. And he's done this for at least 60 colleges and universities. It's the largest program in the country. And I know personally that Dr. Freeburg is known very well in international school circles for the work that he's done.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a remarkable job with that program. So that was one during that tenure that...
Yeah, real ornament, actually, for
yes.
the institution. Yeah. Yeah. Then you decided to move more substantially into administration.
Yes.
Became okay. a vice president, no
That's
less.
Right. Well, not at first. It was an offer, though, made Dr. Dill. Roger Hamilton was the publications director at the time, and he was anxious to get back to department mass communications, his first love of teaching there and the practice of the profession. And Roland, President Dill, asked me to consider becoming director of college relations, which would include publications and some other kinds of functions that were a part of the administrative arm of the university. John Jenkins was director of development, but he was thinking about retiring and he had other duties. And as was typically happening in many colleges, a number of kind of related or complementary programs were being brought together into what was called advancement.
Mm-hmm.
It would be publications, news service, alumni, fundraising, a PR kind of function as well. And so he asked me to head up this program and to try to build that a bit. It was a change, but it was also offered some exciting kinds of possibilities, and so yeah, that was the change. It became vice president a couple years later,
mm-hmm.
in the scheme of things, and it's essentially the job that I've been in for the last 13 years.
And as you look back over that, what do you consider some of the more memorable things that you've been involved with?
Okay. Well, we've grown in fundraising. We've grown to a point where many people in the community would recognize that public higher education has needs for private monies that can be applied to whatever an administration might feel could best serve the university. That is not formula money that typically comes from the legislature.
Just as an aside there, I'm now serving on a United Way committee which deals with development of budget and disposition of funds.
Right.
And the director of the United Way says, we now recognize that the principal figures in community fundraising are the three higher education institutions.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting, yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's...
That's been a long development, which was
yes.
not true even 10 years ago.
No. It has been true of some public higher education in other parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
Major universities, some of them have been eminently successful in raising substantial monies. And as a result, being able to do some things that strengthen the university, without question. One of the things that's been kind of not close to function, but one that has always given me a great deal of satisfaction, fun to associate with, your wife Audrey would know very well, and that was the program of the Heritage Education Commission that's operated, and I've served them in kind of an ad hoc basis as our staffed.
You provided the initiative to get that moving?
Well, the inception of that grew out of a very practical kind of need. I was with my sister, Norma, down in Underwood, who on a Sunday afternoon brought out a couple boxes of documents. I remember marriage certificates, baptismal certificates, confirmation certificates from my parents, other family members. There were some ration books, there were photographs. She was asking, what should we do with this? And, you know, she realized, and we knew that certainly we'd want it destroyed, but on the other hand, who wants to keep storing it or whatever? It has some value, and maybe there'll be people interested sometime. And driving back from that, I'm basically in some ways kind of a lazy person. I thought, well, now, there's a lot of people who know what to do with stuff like that. How can we, let's have a workshop and try to get some people who know how to preserve documents, how you should, what are important, to speak to those topics. And I mentioned this to Roland. I mentioned it also to Ruth Herring. She was always great for an idea.
Sure.
Mentioned it to Audrey Smirud, who was very anxious to... she was into some preservation kinds of things. And we got an ad hoc group together to consider, let's have a history for family, for a workshop for family history. And that group planned it so well that it was, what did they have? They had 75 people or something like that.
Oh, it was a big success.
Yeah, it really was. Mm-hmm. And they've done it annually ever since. That group is a freestanding group that's supported by the university and relates to the university, but they've expanded into other things. And I can get no more satisfaction from anything than going and just sitting in one of their meetings, because they're always purposeful, directed, they accomplish things, they're providing a tremendous regional service.
Mm-hmm.
I think their enrollments now are up to 200 for family history workshops, and I know that people just count on it each year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they have this project about which we are involved is one of theirs, and of course the church history too.
Yes,
I remember.
Yep, right.
Mm-hmm. Clearly, you had a major role in development in this whole golf course science center too, and I think it'd be important to get that covered.
One of my duties when I came over to administration was to serve as the executive for the Morehead State University Foundation. It had been created just a few years earlier. It was raising money each year for scholarships. It had a board of 24 people, an executive committee of 6 that met regularly to consider their mission. The bylaws creating the organization were very broadly stated. Any kind of thing that might support the university would be a legitimate function of the foundation, but the primary practices at the time were scholarships. That was something that people in the region understood. That was some way of supporting Morehead State. There was some reluctance to provide other kinds of money, I think, in ways we touched on here just a bit ago. But scholarships, everybody could understand needs for that. About 77 or 78... we were told that the Fargo Elks Lodge was looking for someone to whom they might donate the golf course. And there were several possible recipients here in the community. But word had come to our then president of the foundation, Dennis Trofe, president of Morehead State Bank, that the Elks would be interested in donating someplace. He let me know quickly, he and I let our president, Dill, know very quickly that this was going to happen. And that led to a meeting of the executive committee of the foundation and some dialogue with the Elks Board of Trustees, which ended up in that gift,
mm-hmm.
the gift to the foundation. The foundation, and not only that, but the Elks would operate the golf course for the foundation for at least 5 years. They had been able to use some of their gaming funds for the operation of that, and the Attorney General's ruling in the state of North Dakota ruled out that continuation, and so they had to give the golf course away. And we were delighted to work out an arrangement whereby we could become the recipient of it. Now, they were operating the golf course for the first 5 years. It was a lease-back kind of arrangement, but it was only for 5 years, and after that time, we would have to start operating the golf course. That was a part of the overall transaction. Sometime after we had acquired the property, I remember Tom Collins coming to me as the foundation executive to say, would it be all right to bring students from his class out there and conduct certain kinds of experiments? Well, of course, that would that would be even a more suitable purpose than golfing, and so by all means, he was able to do that. In fact, he had a couple of requests, and it became apparent that there were lots of features out there that could support science education. The property was unique. It had a variety of features that could support science education. Well, to explore this idea, it ought to be done by higher education, but pre-collegiate again, too, in the way that our institution has associated with and collaborated with area schools. We were able to get some money from the Danforth Foundation through the Danforth Associates Program to invite in 60 people. And we invited elementary, junior, senior high teachers, Department of Natural Resources people to represent interest groups, ornithologists and other kinds of groups, the astronomy people, and as well as our own faculty and faculty from Morehead, Concordia, and NDSU. The money provided us to give them meals for two Saturdays in February of that year. And the question was posed, if we were to think about creating this as a special facility for science, certainly in Fargo-Moorhead we had all kinds of things for music, for art, for sports, but we really didn't have a facility that focused on science. If we were to start thinking about this property out at the Ponderosa as being a center for science, what kinds of things could happen? And the ideas just started to percolate and roll out of that group. In the two sessions, there was a resounding endorsement for the idea, yes, we ought to create a science center. With that kind of blessing, a feasibility study was conducted. The foundation obtained something like $25,000 from a variety of sources, the Alex Stern Foundation locally, the FM Foundation, the Black Foundation, from other sources as well, to retain a firm that might look at the property and decide how it might best serve as a science center. And that, since then, it's been a matter of expanding on that idea and more people being involved in developing it.
Its present status, is Morehead State completely... Elks have no longer any role.
They
in
still have. There was a. We were buying it really on contract for deed.
Right.
It was. When I say it was gifted. We were buying on contract for deed, but gifts provided to us to do precisely that. The last legislature. This last legislature had approved $1.2 million for a science education building to be located out on that site. Now that led to some kinds of negotiations. Because it would be a state building, it would have to be on state land rather than on foundation land. The property is really owned by foundation.
Mm-hmm.
Because we had still something to pay on contract for deed, we had sessions with the Elks, renegotiated. The foundation now owns all of the property as a kind of collateral for the amount that remains on the contract for deed. The Elks technically own the existing lodge building out on site. And as soon as we've paid off the balance of the contract for deed, 3 years hence, we will also own that building. But we needed to have clear title to land so we in turn, we meaning the foundation, could donate acreage to the state of Minnesota for the building of the science education building.
Are plans underway now for that new structure?
Right. There's a planning committee that's working on that. And I think next fiscal year would be construction year. Whether or not it could be completed by summer of 89, I think, is a question. But
And the contemplation is, is there an observatory going to be part of that? Or what will the function of the building?
Okay. It will serve as a departure point for a network of trails out on site. The trails would lead to learning stations or research projects underway or whatever. So it would serve as a preliminary preparation point for groups heading out on the trails. It would have elements of an interpretive center. The property, the precise building site, would be on a piece of ground that represents transformation from native prairie grassland to woodland and riverine forest. And so, and it's essentially on a beach of Lake Agassiz, so it has a unique geological and topographical kind of some features. So it might help interpret that transitional kind of zone. It will certainly be a kind of center for certain technological monitoring of experiments conducted out on site. It will be a lab of sorts for certain kinds of work with materials, artifacts, or whatever that's found out there. It could also, in fact, here's one of the more exciting recent notions here, is that it might serve as the hub of a computer network. One of the ideas that's just surfaced now within the last few weeks has to do with the science education and how it's conducted in schools. Certainly science is a body of knowledge, and schools try to deal with that, transmit that. It is certainly a process, the scientific method, and schools try to teach that. But science is a lot more than that, it seems. A person might think about, certain kinds of research. My doctor, if he diagnoses cancer in one of his patients, gets that information off to a regional cancer research center, might ultimately be in Atlanta, Houston, or New York, and there, that bit of information fits into others, that becomes an important part of the science community. In effect, then, science is a community as well, from a local kind of unsophisticated kind of collecting of data to a sophisticated kind of analysis of that. That's something that schools haven't done other than maybe on some of the science fairs that have been conducted. The notion has come up to create a science computer network, so a fifth grade here in Morehead, Probst Field School, conducts an experiment. They describe that, plug it into the computer. It's stored there. Detroit Lakes fifth grade class, hey, you know what they're doing in Morehead? Let's replicate that or modify that. Let's take a variation of that. There'd be a lateral kind of networking, but it could also be vertical. A fifth grader who was quite gifted in science learns, do you know what they're doing over at the high school? And I'd like to look into that some more. There could be a vertical kind of community of science, too. And what, just within the last 2 weeks, we've been talking to EXU people about that hub, creating that network and having the hub at the Science Center. And that looks like that's going to happen. They're very interested in that prospect. So that would be a function, too, that we can't even define yet in terms of the facility. So that's a long about answer there.
You're still in a continuing relationship on this executive board?
Yes.
Somehow or other, as you look back over your career, I guess it would be fair to say that you've been a catalyst, at the very least, in a lot of rather significant developments. We've talked about Language Camp and the Science Center and teaching abroad and professional fourth year. Are there any others we haven't touched on?
No, I think those are the things those I would take greatest pride in and satisfaction.
Justifiably. We need to also just say a little bit about your family now.
Yes.
So why don't you review that for us, too?
Okay. Wife Doris has loved the higher education community. She was a nurse when we were married. She subsequently earned a bachelor's degree here at Morehead State Then she went on from that and went to Brigham Young University and got completed a program and a degree they call nurse practitioner. All four of my children, Beth, the first one that went to Germany with us, has earned her degree. She is now heading up a program at the YWCA in St. Paul. It's a program helping homeless mothers and children somehow or other end up with homes. And son Joe, the first one born in Germany, is a editor of a weekly newspaper in northern New Mexico. He and his wife manage a Girl Scout ranch. They have 22 horses that they take care of. They also do, his wife is a head nurse at a ski dispensary at Angel Fire Ski Slope. And they both have found time to take some kind of training in mountain rescue. They are living an idyllic life, I think.
Sounds like it.
Daughter Heidi has, son Joe graduated from the University of Minnesota, English major. The next one was daughter Heidi, who graduated from Morehead State in mass communications. She spent a year in Russia as a governess with an American family stationed there, part of the diplomatic corps. And grew to like Marines, subsequently married a Marine captain, and they're living in New Haven, Connecticut, currently. I imagine they're going to be living in different places on this planet during the course of his career. Youngest son, John, is currently a student at Morehead State. He had come and gotten a degree earlier in hotel-motel management. Tried it out, didn't like that field. He's now back in elementary education, so he's going to carry on the tradition in our family.
The only one, though.
The only one of the four, yeah.
Yeah.
All four are married. The oldest two each have a son, so we have two grandsons.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've covered a lot of ground, several institutions. Is there anything else you think we ought to cover?
I think I've talked too long already, Bill.
No,
thanks very much.
No, I think it's going to be a very, very interesting record. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill.